This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take a look at recent attacks to the ancient Armenian settlement of Kassab in Syria.
The Turks, which already committed a genocide 99 years ago, want to kill more Armenians. Hard to believe.
We'll hear a talk given by journalist Max Blumenthal at an event in New York titled Against Israeli Apartheid.
We interviewed Max before about his book Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Now hear him speak at Israel Apartheid Week.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Heidi, when you were in high school or junior high, were there high school monitors in the hall that you might not have cared for?
Of course, Michael. We used to hang out by the lockers in the hallway and say not too nice things about them, but under our breath.
Right. Well, recently there's a case that challenges a kid's right to talk about their hall monitors. Hall monitors can do whatever they want to the kids, and the kids apparently can't complain. But this resulted in a victory for the young person. Tell us about it, Heidi.
Well, 2 years ago, 13-year-old Riley Stratton from Minnewaska, Minnesota, was called into a room by her school counselor, and there was a police officer present. She was ordered to hand over the password to her Facebook account because she'd written on Facebook that she hated a school hall monitor because she was mean.
I love that. I mean, that's incredible. Even before you go on, Heidi, does that mean that the school was checking the Facebook of the students?
I think that's essentially what happened, Michael. School officials threatened to suspend her for what she said on social media. And she complied because she was 13 years old. A police officer was there. But her parents objected, saying that they felt it wasn't the school's business to monitor her communications off school grounds. The ACLU of Minnesota represented her. They settled recently for $70,000. Representatives of the school said their actions were misunderstood, but they did say new policies addressing online behavior have been added to school rules, along with training for teachers and staff. So, Michael, what's the moral of this story?
Use Twitter.
A lot of schools, like the folks at Minnewaska area schools, think that just because it's easier to know what kids are saying off campus through social media doesn't mean that the rules have somehow changed and you can punish them for what they say off campus. That's what the attorney for the ACLU argued, and obviously it's true. Get your nose out of my Facebook.
Well, in the good news department, although the underlying case was tragic, Guild members Cynthia Heenan and Buck Davis in Detroit settled a 2012 Saginaw High Noon Shopping Center parking lot firing squad case. And if you think the facts of that sound odd, they are. A 49-year-old mentally distressed African-American had taken a cup of coffee from a gas station, and as a result, he was shot down by 7 white officers who stood in a line with rifles 20 feet away. Now, the police also brought, improperly, a police dog, a canine unit, to the scene, and kept threatening the man with the dog to get him to drop his 3-inch pocket knife. A couple of experts in the case said it was the worst handling of a standoff with a mentally ill person they'd ever seen. The dog should never have been there. There was no hostage team, no negotiations, no alternative or lesser uses of force, absolutely no command structure, and no order to fire. In this incident, the last time the police ran the dog to the man, within 10 feet of him, he turned toward it, and then the firing began. There were altogether 47 shots fired, 11 hits, 5 of which were in the man's back, and he died, of course, on the scene. They settled the case for $725,000.
It's reminiscent of what just happened in Albuquerque, where that video went viral about the cops there essentially assassinating a homeless man on a hill.
And apparently it's going on rampantly in Albuquerque. That's like the 12th man, I think, who's been assassinated, who is a homeless, perhaps mentally ill man. It's apparently a big issue in many cities in the country, the assassination. You know, we read about Brazil and say, oh, they're, you know, they just go around like before the Olympics and just kill, you know, young kids or people who are on the streets. And, well, it's not so different here.
Michael Ratner, the Supreme Court just handed down a disturbing decision on campaign finance laws.
I wish it were April 1st and this was just another April Fool's joke, but it's not. Our Supreme Court always at the ready to ensure that the 1% will dominate the 99% at the polls, so it's their candidates that will be elected. Here's the headline of the article. Supreme Court strikes down campaign contribution limits. It's 5-4. I'll explain very briefly. If you're financing or giving money to political parties, political fronts, or candidates, your maximum you can give in any one election cycle is $123,000. You can give a maximum of $2,600 to each individual candidate and $32,000 to political party committees. But the total can't be more than $123,000. If you were to start giving to 20 members of Congress and, you know, 10 different committees, you'd go over the total. So the Supreme Court basically, in its great wisdom in this 5-4 decision, said that, no, we're not going to hold people to a limit. $123,000 is not any kind of limit. In fact, there shouldn't be a limit. You can give as much as you want in total. They didn't strike down the individual donations, $2,600 or $32,000 for a party committee, but you can go up to a maximum of whatever you want, hundreds of thousands of dollars, to give money to political candidates. And just a couple of the quick comments on the website, a couple of great ones. Quote, yet another nail in the coffin of American democracy. Well, what was left of American democracy. Another one. Again, all this is freedom of speech for the wealthy. Michael Smith?
This case is the companion case to Citizens United. We've been all been waiting for it and predicting the 5-4 vote, and sure enough, it happened. Citizens United, as our listeners will remember, is a case that grants corporate personhood to corporate donations on the basis that corporations are persons, and therefore corporations can give as much money as they want. The observation that I liked about this was that I'll believe a corporation is a person the day it gets a colonoscopy. But evidently, the Supreme Court doesn't agree. They say a corporation's a person. They can give as much as they want. And now a person who's a person can give as much as they want. $123,000 isn't enough. This is a plutocracy. And since both parties rely on the same rich people, it's really a one-party state.
On that issue, you know, I think, I don't know where the ACLU stood in this particular case. Generally, under the, quote, free speech views of the ACLU, they don't support any limits on campaign finance. So I'm not sure where they came out in this case. I would imagine on the wrong side. It's nice to quote some of our fine Republicans on the case. Our nice House Speaker, Representative John Boehner, in comments after the decision, doesn't like the campaign finance law, likes the decision, and says, quote, what I think this means is that freedom of speech is being upheld. Quote, you all have the freedom to write what you want to write. Donors ought to have the freedom to give what they want to give. There you go. Our wonderful democracy, as someone said, another nail in the coffin.
Michael Ratner, last week John Kerry abruptly changed his plans to meet with Palestinian leaders. What happened?
No, I think he was tired of flying to the Middle East. I mean, maybe the food wasn't that good on the private jet, but in any case, he did cancel his trip, and he canceled the trip after the head of the PA, Abbas, decided that he was going to join some of the international agencies, and because he decided to do that, Kerry doesn't know what to do now, because the understanding of the United States that it was trying to force down the Palestinians' throat is that they wouldn't join any of these agencies, the negotiations would continue, Israel would continue to free political prisoners, and that the issue should be settled by negotiations. The Israelis, of course, for a long time feared the recognition of Palestine by the UN. Of course, the General Assembly essentially did that in their General Assembly resolution, and that allows Palestine to join all these international institutions. Palestine refrained from doing it on the grounds that they thought perhaps that Kerry was really going to push Israel to do the right thing here.
And also release political prisoners by the end of March, which
right.
they didn't do.
So the holdup is the last tranche of political prisoners have not been released by Israel. They want the Palestinians to agree to keep this thing going forever.
No, through 2015, Michael. No. Be fair here.
Okay. So the Palestinians are fighting back a little bit. It took this to get Abbas to, like, move a hair. But Michael has an interesting question of how much hair he actually moved, because of the 63 institutions, he didn't join the ones that perhaps are the most important.
Yeah, the International Criminal Court.
Right. He didn't join the International Criminal Court, and he didn't join the International Court of Justice at The Hague. Now, joining those two would have given Palestinians and others a right to go against Israel in those courts. He didn't do that.
And why do you think he didn't do that?
Well, I think he's taking measured steps. He's going so far to see if maybe now that they see he's serious, quote serious, the Israelis will begin to release the prisoners, because they say the Israelis are saying to themselves, what if he joins the ICC and the International Court of Justice at The Hague? So in some way it's a big game, but it is interesting that here Kerry has put his prestige and that of the United States on being able to slap Israel around a tiny, 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 tiny bit, and he can't even get the tiny, tiny, tiny bit. And so Palestine, with its weakness, is moving a tiny, tiny bit. Let me just say, it's a great thing that Abbas did this, that he joined
agreed.
The 15.
Yeah.
Even though it's tiny and it's small, I mean, this should have been happening a long
important.
Time ago, in my view.
Yeah.
But it's still a great, great thing.
The other interesting thing about this is that to keep this stall going, the United States finally agreed to put on the table the release of this Israeli spy, Michael Pollard. Pollard has served about 29 years in prison so far. Pollard sold American secrets to the Israelis. He was in it for the money. He sold so many secrets, it took a room 6 foot by 6 foot by 10 feet high to hold all the stuff that they sold him. And Caspar Weinberger, the then Secretary of Defense, was so irate, he demanded the death penalty for Pollard, but they only gave him life in prison. The Israelis have been trying to get the United States to release him. And the intelligence community, it's a euphemism calling these people a community, but not
or intelligent. Call them. What's the word for these people?
Spooks.
Killers.
Spooks.
But anyway, they've resisted because of the damage this guy did. So Obama was willing to give Kerry another chit that will let Pollard out of prison early if you can keep these negotiations going. So they threw that in the basket. But
and he'll go back to Israel. Not back. He'll go to Israel because Pollard has been made a citizen of the state of Israel.
Yeah.
So he'll go back. Now, one interesting thing about the Palestinian recognition of these international institutions, not recognition, but signing on to some of them, the 15, Washington has opposed, of course, the membership. And it could prompt a withdrawal of financial aid to the Palestinian Authority.
Yeah.
And a shutdown of Palestinian diplomatic mission in Washington, because that our Congress in its great wisdom to make sure that Palestine didn't sign on to any of the institutions said, we're going to take away the money and you're going to be forced to shut your embassy, or not your embassy, your diplomatic mission, whatever they call it officially, if you sign these. So it's going to be interesting to see this unroll. We never thought this had any chance at all. And it's in some way very sad, but in some way it verifies what I think our little team here of Heidi, Michael Smith, and Michael Ratner have felt for a long time.
Michael, hard to believe it's that time again. The Brooklyn Folk Festival is coming up.
6th Annual Brooklyn Folk Festival, April 18th, 19th, and 20th at the Bell House in Brooklyn. Old-time string bands, blues, jug bands, traditional Indonesian, Balkan music, New Orleans jazz, songwriters, and more. And a square dance, films, workshops,
but fun.
And the famous banjo toss. Ask me about the
What's
banjo toss.
What's the banjo toss?
They throw a banjo to the Gowanus Canal, which is a super fun sight.
Ruin that instrument.
It's a sacrificial banjo.
Okay.
But when they haul it in, they got to wear rubber gloves.
To protect themselves.
Last year, shot putter from Cincinnati won. And you don't get the one you're throwing away. You get a new banjo for it.
Okay.
The Brooklyn Folk Festival, it's at brooklynfolkfest.com. It's presented by Down Home Radio and the Jalopy Theater. Down Home Radio is my son, Eli Smith, and they've got 30 bands. It's a terrific thing. Brooklyn is the center for the revival of folk music in America. So check it out, April 18th, 19th, and 20th, the Brooklyn Folk Festival.
It is an amazing event. I've gone every year and love it. And for you people listening who are over 65, which I know are some of our listeners, there's a smaller banjo they give you to throw. I almost won last year with the tiny banjo.
I don't get why the older people have a smaller banjo.
Because the bigger one is heavier. It's harder
to throw. In the early hours of March 21st, civilians in the ancient Armenian settlement Kasab and surrounding villages were attacked by forces opposed to the Syrian government crossing the border from Turkey. Kasab is an Armenian-populated town situated in northwestern Syria. The cross-border attacks, which included church desecrations, forced the immediate civilian evacuation of the area, alarming Armenians around the globe concerned about the safety of their relatives. Long considered a safe haven for refugees fleeing nearby war-torn cities, in recent years, the local Armenian population in Kasab has increased. In response to the recent multi-pronged attack, the Armenian National Committee of America has called on Barack Obama and Congress to press Turkey to stop facilitating attacks on civilians in Kasab, to investigate Turkey's reported assistance to foreign fighters associated with U.S.-designated terrorist groups, and to direct humanitarian aid to victims in the Armenian settlement. To tell us more about this conflict, we're joined today by Aram Hamparian, Executive Director of the Armenian National Committee of America. Aram, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi.
Let's start by providing an overview of what the recent attacks on the town of Kasab mean, to Armenians in particular.
Sure. Kasab holds tremendous meaning for Armenians around the world. It's essentially the last Armenian village that remains on the territory of the former Ottoman Empire, the territory that was emptied of Armenians during the Armenian genocide of 1915. A portion of those survivors settled in this village, which is right on the Turkish border, and for 9 decades they lived in safety, but in the shadow of Turkey, until just recently when extremist militants invaded the village from Turkey and drove out about 2,000 residents who are essentially homeless today.
I understand that previously this town had evaded Syrian conflict. What changed?
I think that a decision was made in Ankara, in Turkey, to allow extremists to use their territory to drive the Armenians out of that village. I think there's an element of intent on the part of the Turkish government, which has sadly been consistently anti-Armenian now for more than a century, and sort of a convergence of interests with a very extremist group within Syria. I think it's known as ISIL, ISIL, Samantha Power, the UN ambassador today, condemned their efforts and their attack on the town. Some of these groups have a very different vision of religious tolerance and freedom of faith than we do here, and don't see perhaps a role for the Armenian minority to stay within that country.
Is it accurate that about 6,000 Armenians lived in this particular area, but that after the 1915 massacre, I think 5,000 were killed?
I think that today the number is closer to 2,000. It's the springtime, so it's a very beautiful area right on the ocean, the Mediterranean Sea. So the numbers go up in the summer, but there's only about 2,000 people there now. There were larger numbers prior to the genocide. Of course, we lost many there during 1915. But the numbers today are around 2,000, and essentially everybody except a few elderly are gone, and we worry about those 30 or 40 people who we can't account for. Thankfully, nobody, only one person we understand, was killed by a sniper, the Washington Post reported this morning, but the overwhelming majority have fled, but in safety, to the city of Latakia, which is just south, about 45 minutes south of Kesa.
And what is the involvement of the Armenian National Committee of America in this?
Well, we've really worked very hard to encourage our government, the U.S. government, to protest not only the attack, but also Turkey's role we've been encouraged that immediately after the attack, the State Department condemned this and did so forcefully, but they didn't condemn what we felt was the key element, which was that Turkey allowing these soldiers to cross and, the border and make this attack. Hiding them. The thing is about Kesab is that it's literally right on the border. There are parts of Kesab that are just, you know, 100 yards away from a highly militarized, highly monitored border. It's inconceivable that soldiers would have crossed that border had they not been supported by, or at the very least, ignored by the Turkish government.
You've strongly urged the government to send a firm message that the safe haven and safe passage that is essentially being offered to militant groups on destroying Kesab must end. I understand that a few senators have issued their own letter to the president, citing the expulsion of Armenians and saying how it is a reminder of the genocide.
Sure. Senator Menendez, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, a little while ago, Congresswoman Jackie Speier, who's one of two Armenian-Americans in Congress, spoke forcefully about this. Basically, you know, we know there's tremendous suffering across Syria, and we sympathize, of course, with all those who pay such a heavy price for this conflict. As Armenians, we have many relatives in the Armenian community. We'd really like the Armenians of Kesab to be able to go home, but they simply can't go home if there's a fear of repetition. If the precedent that's set is, well, Turkey did this once, they were not challenged at all, and being given a free pass, then our fear is that if the day comes when these citizens can go back to their homes, they'll just be in danger immediately of the same thing happening again. So we're trying to get a message from Washington to Ankara that says, you know, this is out of bounds. You need to protect your border. You have the right to protect your border, but you also have to make sure that your border is not crossed by militants who are doing harm to innocent civilians. And that's been our message in meetings with the State Department and in our discussions with Congress.
Given the Obama and other administrations' reluctance or failure to come forth and really formally acknowledge the genocide, do you think that political forces are at play in terms of our relations with Turkey that might prevent a strong statement on this issue?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's all of one cloth. President Obama came into office having pledged repeatedly to recognize the genocide. We have a 24-page record of his various statements on the subject, and it's rather extensive and actually very eloquent. Soon after coming into office, he turned 180 degrees and instead not only didn't honor his pledge to recognize genocide, but actually blocked Congress from doing what he said he would do. So we've dealt with a very unfortunate record by the president, but it sets a pattern which says that on human rights issues, on issues of values, on issues of principle, we're willing to outsource our policy to Ankara, to Turkey. And just as a reminder, Turkey has banned YouTube. Turkey has banned Twitter because its leaders are, you know, not happy with what's being said. We shouldn't outsource our policies on human rights to groups of, especially countries that don't themselves respect human rights. And this is the unfortunate situation we're in. I think we have the reluctance of our president to stand up to Turkey's role in this attack is unfortunately akin to the bigger issue of why they won't just honor the historical record and recognize the Armenian genocide.
I read a report, just going back to what happened on the 21st of March, that those civilians who were unable to flee have reportedly been taken hostage while churches and their homes were desecrated. Are those reports accurate, to the best of your knowledge?
You know, it's a good question, Heidi. We're not really sure. Our sense is that there haven't really been a lot of casualties. We understood that there was one woman who was killed during the escape from the city, but we haven't heard about a lot of fatalities, nor have we heard about any specific desecrations of churches, and we welcome that. I think the facts that we know are that a village of about 2,000 people, a historic Armenian presence in that territory, was driven out, and that they're now homeless. That's kind of the facts as we know them today.
Right, and I guess probably reports of church desecrations came given the history of that in the early part of the 20th century as a symbolic means of part of the genocide. If people are interested in assisting or learning more, where can they go for information?
Well, they could turn to the Armenian National Committee of America. We're known as the ANCA. You can look us up on Facebook or through Google. And there's all sorts of ways that people can talk to Congress and talk to the administration about how to raise this issue with elected officials. At the same time, there's a really good group called the Syrian Armenian Relief Fund, SARF, and again, you can find them on Google, and they're raising money for relief efforts and basically for food, medicine, the really simple stuff that'll help these families survive. Many of them are staying with friends or relatives. Others are living in the church in neighboring Latakia. Our hope is to help these folks get back to their homes. So those are two groups. So the ANCA, on the one hand, on the political side, and the Syrian Armenian Relief Fund is doing some great work helping refugees. And they've made a special point of whenever they provide aid to Armenian villagers throughout Syria, they've made a special point of helping everyone in the community, because this isn't, the Armenians are not alone in being targeted or suffering. Syrians of every background have suffered horrifically, and we sympathize with all of them and want to help as many as we possibly can.
Yes, definitely. Given that April 24th will be the 99th anniversary of the Armenian genocide, what kind of events are happening nationally?
Sure. We're going to have an event in the U.S. Congress on April 9th, because of the way the congressional schedule works out. We're going to have an observance of the Armenian genocide on Capitol Hill. There'll be members of Congress from both parties, from the House and Senate there. It'll be a chance for hundreds of Armenians from around the country to join together in that observance. One thing that troubles us, and this is really a sad thing, which is that every year we make a point of inviting our White House and our State Department to simply be present during that commemoration, and they have boycotted it every year. And unfortunately, we'll not even send a desk officer to bear witness to this congressional observance, which is, it just shows you that, you know, in foreign policy, very often our policies are not set here, and they certainly don't reflect American values, but instead reflect the wishes and desires and even the really sometimes the hateful sensitivities of foreign governments.
Mm. You know, it's so interesting. My grandparents came over during the genocide, and I understand that there's sometimes an alternation of generations so that their children weren't really that interested in being active. And then I find it so fascinating because so many people don't really know what happened to the Armenians. And understandably so, because our history books in this country don't really acknowledge it.
It's really true. Thankfully, we've been working state by state to try to get the genocide introduced during social studies or history classes, and we've had some success in like New York and Michigan, California, Rhode Island, some other states. But we cooperate with groups like Facing History and groups like the Genocide Education Project to try to, you know, get this component into public schools. And in terms of the Armenian community, I think it has been an uneven thing, and we skip generations very often. But I think today there's more advocacy on this issue than there's ever been, and that's 100 years after the fact. And I think that speaks to the fact that this terrible thing that happened a long time ago, it still lives with us. And the challenges that Armenia faces, the terrible suffering that took place recently in Kesab, it all has its roots in this still unpunished crime. And if we could just address that issue and find some way to resolve it fairly, I think it would be good for Armenia, it would be good for Turkey, it would be good for America, it would be good for the world.
That's beautifully put. And I want to thank you so much for all the work that you've been doing, and really hope that these atrocities will be brought to light and that at some point our government will formally acknowledge this. But thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Heidi.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.
We go now to hear a presentation by award-winning journalist and best-selling author Max Blumenthal, who spoke at the event titled Against Israeli Apartheid, along with Palestinian journalist Ali Abu Nima. Max's new book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, shows the reader how the Netanyahu right-wing government is actually moderate compared to most other institutions in Israel. His book takes a hard look at Israeli authoritarian politics through a cross-section of interviews from the homes of Palestinian activists to the political leaders behind the organized assault on democratic rights. Let's have a listen.
You know, it's clear to me from being on all sorts of campuses around the country that if Palestinian bodies mattered as much to campus administrators and campus presidents like John Sexton, the bodies of Palestinians from Yarmouk to Gaza, as much as the feelings of Zionists on campus or the bottom line is of their corporate donors, we wouldn't have to be sitting here today. That's really why we're sitting here. That's really why we're talking about this. And I think Ali's book is the perfect complement to my book because it explains where things are going in Congress, in this country, in the West, and on campus. I think his section, The Battle for Campus, in his book is essential to understand where things are going. Me and Ali wrote our books. He told me not to talk about this, not to ruin this special place, because New Yorkers seem to have this capacity for taking places over that are previously special. It's called Marfa. It's a little town in West Texas, has like one stoplight. It's currently being overtaken by hipsters. And me and Ali had writing residencies there, and we each wrote sections of our book in this very special place. And Ali writes in his book about a school in Marfa that forced Latino students, I mean, this is a town on the border with a border patrol station, and this school forced students in the 60s, Latino students, to actually have a funeral for the Spanish language in the front yard, to bury Spanish words in the front yard of the school. The cemetery in this town is still segregated between Latino and Anglo. And so the ghosts of the past, or the dark ghosts of the southwestern past in the U.S., are still alive. As William Faulkner said, the past is never dead, it isn't even past. And Ali connects this legacy to the present in Israel-Palestine in a brilliant way. And it's something that, you know, I've made the connection just on my book tour, noticing, for example, that I was attacked on the House floor by Louis Gohmert, this right-wing Republican representative, not exactly the sharpest tool in the toolbox, but a tool nonetheless. He's an evangelical Christian, and he called me on the House floor an anti-Semitic Jew, because in this, you know, with Congress embracing this mentality of Netanyahu's form of Zionism, evangelical Christians get to decide who's a bad Jew and who's a good Jew. And so I noticed that Louis Gohmert is from he's from Nacogdoches. It's not in the Marfa area, but it's in Texas. And Gohmert has also called for a West Bank-style solution to the immigration crisis in the U.S., to building an Israeli-style wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. And I noticed that last week, Elbit Systems, which is a state-owned Israeli arms and private security supplier, got a $140 million contract from the Department of Homeland Security to provide the monitoring system on the U.S.-Mexico border wall. I noticed that Louis Gohmert and his allies are behind a full-scale attack on ethnic studies and an attack on the communal spaces of Latinos and indigenous people in the Southwest. And this has really taken place in Arizona, where Jan Brewer, the governor, actually called the teaching of ethnic studies and Chicano studies in high school a form of racism. This is Jan Brewer, who is herself a kind of settler. And books. Ali talks about how books by Paulo Freire and Rudy Acuna and Leslie Marmon Silka were actually kind of banned from high schools in Arizona. Then I noticed I got attacked recently by the Brandeis Center, not connected to Brandeis University, but this is a think tank, kind of a quasi-think tank run by someone named Kenneth Marcus, who is behind the campaign to water down Title VI of the Civil Rights Act in order to protect the feelings of Zionist students on campus who claim that what we're doing here today is a form of anti-Semitism. That's, of course, an attempt to attack Palestine solidarity, to undermine protected speech on campus, but it also has a larger agenda of diluting Title VI in general to weaken the legitimate claims of minority students. And I noticed that the Brandeis Center is working hand in glove with an organization called the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, which is funded by the Koch brothers, and is working with Dick Cheney's wife, Lynn Cheney, in an effort to crush ethnic studies. And so they're using this attack on Palestine solidarity on campus, this attack on Students for Justice in Palestine, as kind of a battering ram. Students for Justice in Palestine is the canary in the coal mine, but they have a larger agenda. And once they manage to pass these resolutions or these bills in state houses, as in Maryland and Florida and in New York, punishing academic organizations like ASA for calling on a boycott of Israeli academic institutions, where does it stop? It doesn't stop with Palestine solidarity. It goes all the way to ethnic studies, to gender studies, and to everything else that gets in their way, to eliminating any space for any marginalized group on campus. And I think that is something that Ali understands and distills perfectly in his book. But then we move to my book, to one of the opening scenes where I'm sitting in the office of Alex Miller. He is a 28-year-old native of Moscow. And he is a top deputy of Avigdor Lieberman, the former Moldovan bouncer and baggage handler from Ben-Gurion International Airport, who has become one of Israel's most popular politicians on a very simple platform of stripping Palestinian citizens of Israel of their citizenship rights if they fail to declare loyalty to Zionism. And so Miller's sitting there in the Knesset. He was elected in 2009. He's no longer there. This native of Moscow, and he is the author of the Nakba Law. And he explains to me that he is passing this law because it's an act of shared values. In the United States, there's a law against burning the flag. And I said, actually, I told him there isn't actually a law against it. I mean, Hillary Clinton may have expressed support for it, but it didn't actually pass after everyone saw Kid Rock kind of wearing an American flag on his neck at the Republican National Convention. It became kind of a farce. And I reminded him of Frederick Douglass's famous address on July 4th when he declared that he could never see the foundation of the United States as anything but a tragedy for his people until slavery was abolished. This is how Palestinians feel about the state of Israel. As you can imagine, our meeting didn't go very well. And that bill passed. And that bill was intended to accomplish something very similar to what Jan Brewer did in Arizona. First of all, it passed in diluted form, and so it allows for civil penalties for people who observe the Palestinian Nakba, the dispossession and ethnic cleansing of 750,000 people between 1947 and 1948. But it started with a campaign against textbooks. It started with Limor Livnat, the Minister of Sports and Culture, declaring that the teaching of the Nakba was an existential threat to Israel and promoted disloyalty. It started with Netanyahu and his cadres taking books, high school books, off of bookshelves in bookstores across Israel that contained a single line informing Jewish Israeli students that Palestinians considered 1948 to be a tragedy. And it led straight to legislation, the kind of legislation we're now seeing crop up in our state houses and which will eventually appear in Congress. Now, what does it mean that this legislation is appearing in Israel? What does it say about the current situation in Israel? There's a book right now that's gotten a lot more coverage than my book. It's called My Promised Land. It's by a guy who's considered the Thomas Friedman of Israel. His name is Ari Shavit. And, you know, like Thomas Friedman, this book contains no footnotes or citations. It's been heavily promoted by Charlie Rose, by David Brooks, by David Remnick, by Jeffrey Goldberg. I mean, you name it. They've promoted it, and I feel to some degree that it's been deployed in place of my book. so that they can ignore the facts contained on in the pages of my book. But the book's really interesting because it presents in a fairly unvarnished, unsanitized form an account of the ethnic cleansing of the city of Lida in 1948, and makes no attempt to cover up the fact that this was an act of deliberate ethnic cleansing to establish a Jewish state. But Shavit goes further than that, and he says that this needed to happen in order for me to be born. And in the end, yes, they were criminals, but I will stand with the criminals. So you have a book that's making an open... It's open apologia for ethnic cleansing, heavily promoted in the U.S., mostly by liberals. And it's an interesting book, not only because of that phenomenon, but because Shavit seems to think that 1948 and the Nakba ended in 1948. And that's one of the key differences between his book and my book, which also presents the ethnic cleansing of Lida, but as an ongoing process. So in my book, we go to the Abu Aid refugee camp in Lod. Lida has been Hebraicized as Lod. It is now under the control of the openly supremacist Shas party. And there is an active plan to Judaize the city, to push out the remaining Palestinians who managed to hold on after 1948. So I arrive at the Abu Aid refugee camp. It's not a real refugee camp. It's simply a collection of families who had lived together since before the foundation of the State of Israel. And when I arrive, their homes are reduced to rubble by bulldozers sent by the Israel Lands Administration. It looks like Gaza after Cas Lead. It looks like Aleppo right now. There are children doing their homework in tents. There are men standing around open flames trying to keep warm during rainy season. And I talked to a man from one of the Abu Aid families, and he tells me that we demand UN protection. The days of 48 have come again. I heard this over and over and over again in places on both sides of the Green Line, but primarily behind the Green Line, in parts of Israel that would be legitimized under a two-state solution. Their homes were demolished simply because they had built without permits, permits that they can't receive because they're not Jewish. And this is the same situation for Palestinians in Gaza, who are my neighbors when I lived on Dr. Ehrlich Street in Gaza, which used to be known as Fuad Dajani Street. Fuad Dajani was one of the original was from the Dajani family and one of the original Palestinian aristocratic families that helped drive the campaign of Palestinian nationalism in the 20s. He founded the local hospital. In 1948, his hospital was expropriated by the State of Israel. His staff were expelled, and it's been renamed Jacob Zahalon Geriatric Center after a 17th century Italian Jewish physician who is as familiar to the people of Jaffa as an ice skating rink. And so I'm there noticing that there are 500 standing eviction orders all applying to Palestinians just 5 minutes south of Tel Aviv. This campaign of Judaization, what the Israeli government calls Judaization, replacing indigenous Palestinians with Jews, was taking place right in my neighborhood in the area that liberal Zionists like Peter Beinart call a flawed democracy. And it was because they had simply built without permits. They had attempted to renovate their kitchen without permits. There's no Bob Vila for Palestinians in Israel. And I noticed, I went to the village of Al-Araqib and was told the same thing. The days of 48 have come again by those residents as they watched their homes demolished for the third time, and I filmed. There were plans to build a forest on top of their land by the Jewish National Fund, a 501c3 nonprofit that raises tens of millions of dollars in the U.S. And has, you know, fundraisers with speeches from Stephen Harper and Bill Clinton. And this village has been demolished 54 times in order to build this forest and to build a Jews-only community that has been authorized to discriminate on the basis of religion and ethnicity through the acceptance to communities law passed by the Knesset. I was told this all over Israel by Palestinians, that 48 has come again. 48 has never ended. But I was also told something similar by right-wing Israelis, like Alex Miller, like Avigdor Lieberman's, like his party mates, like Zev Elkin, who is a top deputy of Netanyahu who favors annexing the West Bank, like Naftali Bennett, who is the economics minister, who recently endorsed a decision by the National Civil Service Administration of Israel to bar religious Jewish women from volunteering in hospitals after 9 p.m. for fear that they would date Arab men, a decision which is lobbied for by Lehava, which is known in Israel as the anti-miscegenation lobby. I thought this was an unusual decision as an American Jew because I've been raised to believe it's good to date doctors. But this is a different place. And what Bennett tells me, what Lieberman says, what the right wing of Likud are saying, their mantra and why they're popular is because they are calling for finishing 48. Their mantra is to finish 48, to finish the job, the unfinished job of producing an ethnically pure Jewish, exclusively Jewish state. Now, this campaign has been ongoing, as I've said, over and over since 1948, and the anti-democratic laws that I've mentioned are not the first anti-democratic laws. This is nothing new. One of the first anti-democratic laws was the Infiltration Prevention Act, passed in 1953 by the Knesset, which outlawed the presence of Palestinian refugees who had attempted to reunite with their families and their land. Even Benny Morris has proven that these Palestinian refugees who attempted to what the government of Israel calls infiltrate were simply returning for purposes of reunification and economic purposes. They had no intention to resist the state of Israel in the majority of cases. So under this law, they were outlawed as infiltrators, and the Border Patrol was authorized to remove them from cities across Israel, often violently. So this law has been amended to take care of a new demographic threat, to remove a new contaminant to the ethnic purity of Israel. And this contaminant is not Palestinian, it is African. These are non-Jewish Africans. They live in Israel. There are about 60,000 of them. The state of Israel refuses to offer them protection or asylum under the UN Convention on Refugee Rights, even though Israel has signed that convention. And it has passed legislation now through this amendment allowing for their indefinite detention. After a series of race riots and firebombings in the community in South Tel Aviv that most Africans were concentrated in, after Miri Regev, the chair of Israel's Knesset Interior Committee, called the Africans at a 1,000-strong right-wing rally in South Tel Aviv a cancer in Israel's national body, and after an Israeli Democracy Institute poll showed that 52% of Jewish Israelis agreed with Regev's statement and that 35% supported violence against non-Jewish Africans, the roundups began. Currently, there are about 500 non-Jewish Africans in the Holot camp in the Negev Desert. This is a camp that Israel refers to as an open accommodation center because technically these Africans are allowed to leave 3 times a day. Of course, there's nowhere to go because they're in the middle of the desert, and they must remain in the camp at night. The camp is closed at night so they're segregated from the Israeli public for fear that they will assimilate, because many of them already speak Hebrew better than Abe Foxman and Alan Dershowitz and could actually contribute to Israeli society if they were allowed to, if only they had J-positive blood. And so this reminded me of another chapter from our past. The historian James Lowen has written a book called Sundown Towns, and he writes about towns that dotted the landscape of the United States, including in Montgomery County, an affluent suburb of Washington, D.C., where Jeffrey Goldberg lives. And many liberal people working in Washington currently live, where ordinances were put in place to illegalize the presence of African Americans after dark. It's why he called them sundown towns. Now, through the implementation of this policy of indefinite detention at the Holot internment center, Netanyahu has made Israel into the world's largest and only sundown town. And he's embraced a policy that is eerily reminiscent of SB 1070, which allows for Latinos to be stopped, frisked, and even arrested on suspicion that they're illegal in Arizona. This is the situation that Africans who are not Jewish in Israel face right now. They can be arrested without charges and held for as long as 3 years. Now, I just want to quickly read a testimony from someone who visited this camp and turn it over to Ali. This is from my friend Allison Dagher, who writes for Mondo Weiss, which is, along with Electronic Intifada, one of the essential websites for gathering information on what's happening on the ground in Israel-Palestine and what's happening in this country. Allison was able to get into the camp, unlike me, and she wrote me this email, which sort of will preview a report that she'll come out with next week. Breakfast daily is one piece of white bread. That's it. The water is not clean and comes from a dirty faucet. They are given cups sometimes. There is not enough soap, and sporadically, they are only allowed to shower once a week. As Africans in Holod are not allowed to work outside of the detention facility, but their basic needs are being met, the state has allowed them to work as the prison's janitors to subsidize their lack of food. For their labor, they receive around $6 per day. Everyone is lanky and moves slow, head sunken. One man I interviewed only leaves his bed 20 minutes a day. The rest of the time he sleeps. People are broken, depressed, and quite frighteningly wasting into waifs. Are they being starved to death? No one has died, and the first and only independent medical review came from Physicians for Human Rights nearly 2 months ago. But it is undeniable that people are thin and sickly, and that something grotesque is happening behind those walls and three metal turnstiles that comprise the front checkpoint. At every turn, Africans are told to leave Israel. By prison guards and in meetings with the Ministry of Immigration, Africans are told to accept voluntary deportation. This is a gotcha moment, because the state has made a written commitment to provide services for free, which is totally illegal under Israeli law. I see no rules being followed in this facility other than that one cannot leave or they will be rounded up and returned within 48 hours. I cannot underscore how much of a horrific scene it is. Holot is not considered by Israel a prison. It's called an open facility. You call it a sundown town. After visiting it, people locked up and thinning, I can only describe it as a concentration camp, and I'm usually very reserved with this kind of language. I've printed that descriptor, but I don't know how else to describe it. Now, Allison is not the first person to call this a concentration camp. Former Speaker of the Knesset, Reuven Rivlin, of the Likud party, also called it a concentration camp. And concentration camps, I was attacked pretty mercilessly for titling my chapter on this camp the concentration camp. But we have to recognize that concentration camps are not unique to Jewish history. They are also familiar to Japanese Americans who were interned at Manzanar in California during World War II because they were deemed to possess enemy race blood. That was the language to justify their indefinite detention, and it's the same mentality, the same language that is being used to justify the detention of non-Jewish Africans, as Benjamin Netanyahu has openly said, they threaten the Jewish demographic, the Jewish character of this state. Someone else who has called it a concentration camp in no uncertain terms is Arnon Sofer, the co-founder of Haifa University and longtime government advisor. Sofer in Hebrew means counter, and he's nicknamed Arnon the Arab Counter because he is the top demographics expert in Israel. He advises governments on how to engineer demographics to preserve the Jewish demographic majority. It was under his advice that Ariel Sharon conducted the Gaza withdrawal. It was under his advice that Sharon built the separation wall to, as Benjamin Netanyahu said, prevent demographic spillover. And now Sofer has conceived the plan for dealing with this new contaminant to the demographic purity of Israel, to the ethnic purity of Israel. He wrote the seminal paper outlining plans for Holot and other camps, and he called for rikuz. Rikuz is the word that's also used on the website of Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Israel, to describe European camps. Rikuz means concentration, and he called for the concentration of Africans. And so we are witnessing the essential logic of an exclusively Jewish state in historic Palestine play out in extremely disturbing fashion. It's playing out before our eyes, and very few people outside this room are saying anything about it. And I think that should be something to think about when we ask ourselves why we're here and what we can do. Thank you.
you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Thank you.